Ladies and gentlemen, and children everywhere.
Audio Dime Museum.
With more laughs, thrills, and chills.
Carnival.
Here we are, in the center ring, under the big top. Why? Well, because of the riddle, of course. Have you solved it? I talk, but I do not speak my mind. I hear words, but I do not listen to thoughts. When I wake, all see me. When I sleep, all hear me. Many heads are on my shoulders, and many hands are at my feet. The strongest steel cannot break my visage, but the softest whisper can destroy me. The quietest whimper can be heard. It's an actor. And every actor needs a stage. As my friend Bill says, all the world's a stage. But this is the best one. I have the feeling that we're playing a game. Has to be around here somewhere. Follow me. Pretending's hard work, you know. You do know something about that, don't you? I'm sure. Make believe. Sounds so lighthearted, fanciful. But sometimes the stakes can be very high. Making people believe you, believe your story, can have all the consequence in the world. Oh, I know. Let's go look behind the curtain. Out here, you see, this is where magic is performed. But back here, back behind the curtain, that's where magic is made. Where the make-believe starts. The answer is an actor. But the finest actor in the world wouldn't have an audience if not for the Ringmaster. I knew it. Here it is. Ironically garish red tails, mercurial top hat. Now that we've found it, let me tell you a story about the answer. Let me tell you a story about the actor and the noble art of deception and the magic of the circus. You tell yourself that at least you won't have to talk for a couple of hours. A couple of hours free from forced smiles and clenched teeth. We're sitting stock still and staring off into the distance. Is it cause for alarm? They call it the most wonderful time of the year. And you are happy to be home. Of course you are. Back to a place where I love yous don't come by post. 6 weeks apart. Where your boots are slick from rain, not clogged with mud. Where meals don't come from a can, and you don't have to think of them getting the bad news. Back to normal. A miniature arm reaches delicately across you, gleefully taking the candy floss from the vendor. There's a sweet simplicity in his excitement. His eyes are as wide as saucers, and his mischievous grin betrays the fact he has no intention of sharing. His father, a dignified sort, in a clean white shirt, reaches out with an over-exaggerated flair and plucks the first bite of the pink cloud for himself. As the boy's red-headed mother laughs at the farcical theft, she has a beautiful smile, the kind of thing that set some soldiers' sweetheart photos apart from the rest. Since you've come home, you've been pretending to be one of these crisp-collared men, a dignified sort, never leaving home without your hat. But you've never been that. You were this boy, just a few years ago, when things weren't so complicated. It feels complicated now. Like a dramatic role with lines to remember and motivations to feign. You know, you used to smile, but was it ever second nature? You can't remember. You can't stay idle. You've tinseled pine and wrapped gifts because you're not sure what to do with your hands or yourself. And maybe that's why you're here, alone on Christmas Eve, for the triumphant return of the greatest show on earth. The lights go down and children gasp, and the drum rolls, and the audience is hungry to believe. My lords, ladies, and gentlemen, the man at the center of the ring begins, as you study his red tail coat and his tall black top hat. Welcome to the Bertram Mills Circus. You can't help but wonder if he was part of the World War, because he doesn't seem to be part of the world. But little do you know that the true ringmaster is pacing just behind the curtain. No, you would never have guessed that war was the theater for one of Mr. Mills' finest performances. Cyril Bertram Mills lived in layers. If he were doing up his necktie and Mimi was looking on from the doorway, he might appear to her to be doing up his necktie. But really, he was thinking. He was thinking about gremlins and about Brazilian newspapers and about how he would like to read about his home if he were very far away. He was thinking about how to make it appear that he wasn't thinking about Brazilian newspapers. He was thinking about how to make it look like he was thinking about doing up his necktie and not thinking about it at all. In the beginning, they called him Bertram's boy. And in the beginning, he hated that. He'd run away from the circus. He'd run away from the circus and from his pedantic Edwardian father and the stuffy shadows of Cambridge, and found himself in the tropics of Burma, building practical things, straight lines and predictable formulas. As an engineer in His Majesty's service, searching for the untapped resources of the world, he was making a real difference, finding a way to fuel tomorrow. Maybe it was the toil, maybe it was the heat, maybe it was the explosions, or maybe it was the fact that once you've arranged transport from Paris to London for 70 lions, sorting out plans for pumps and pipes feels a bit trivial. Destiny would have him on the ground, probing the earth for her bounty, but his true talents were with people, and destiny wouldn't be the last thing he outsmarted. Olympia, home, the circus, called to him, and he returned to offer his unique perspective. He returned to a place where he discovered the most wonderful thing. All you have to do to find yourself in charge of pulling all the strings is to step behind the curtain, out of sight. Anonymity brings power. No, not prestige, but who would want a target like that? To understand the perspective of Mr. Mills, we are to imagine that the world looks like a map, and we are to imagine that people's minds look like the world. Let us imagine that we are looking down from a great height, and that time and plans move like roads over crisp topography. We can see what people will do because we can understand what they want. Because people are like places, and they may be forest or deserts or tundras, seemingly quite different, but they can create their best chance for survival by reaching up and grasping for the sun. And if, from our perch, we can look down and see the world written in roads and see the people written in wants, then we can start to see from the perspective of Mr. Mills. It is no wonder that he wanted an airplane. The browbeating little fuselage insulated him from the rest of the world, offering him the sense of remove that he so often sought. And his grip on the controls gave him complete autonomy. And from up here, the lines of the cities matched the diagrams in his mind, and the people felt like little taps, either on or off, invisible or not concerning, or altogether forgettable. It is no wonder he wanted an airplane. Cyril's little de Havilland Hornet Moth crisscrossed Europe, searching for acts to fill the roster of the Bertram Mills Circus. He sojourned back to the inhospitable jungles of Burma and brought back the giraffe-necked women. Frequenting smaller tents around Europe, he sought out viable talent to recruit, like Con Caliano, a wire walker, some would say the greatest, convincing them that their talents would be better appreciated by His Majesty's Empire, a trend that would continue throughout his next career. He would turn them, offering them a new life where they could perform like professionals and live like gentlemen. Returning from Berlin, where he'd seen a young boy in a tavern flipping teacups and saucers from his foot to the top of his head, he'd offered him a place if he could perform the same act on a unicycle. Above the fatherland, from the air, he noticed a peculiar curve, a line of rail going where rail shouldn't go, deep into the mountains and away from the cities. Rail lines should be practical things, straight lines, predictable. And the peculiar curve of this particular line set off something in his engineer's mind, whispering of plots and plans that were very alarming indeed. Returning home, he reported to MI5, whispering of plots and plans that were very alarming indeed. He didn't know that this would be his new home. He didn't know that he was joining a new circus. Quickly moving up the ranks at MI5, Cyril had gone from ringmaster to spymaster. Once upon a time, there were three men: the painter, the actor, and the ringmaster. Kings of fables, warriors of words, maestros of deception. And this is the story of their greatest feat. As with the circus performers, Cyril could discern the effectiveness of the act by watching the audience's reaction. Face half covered by the curtain, eyes trained on the most unbelieving among them, there was no greater satisfaction than watching the shell of skepticism crack and fall away, leaving them raw and exposed and hungry to believe. He'd seen a crack like this in the Abwehr, the German intelligence agency, as they dropped their arms and stopped keeping the length of them between themselves and Alaric, the code name the Nazis had given to their new greatest asset and his espionage ring in Britain. The Germans were hungry to believe, longing for the fantastic, seeking secrets too fabulous to be real, and Alaric, Garbo, Juan, had them in the palm of his hand. The fairy tale deceptions were woven by the fanciful Spanish actor and the melancholy painter and the stoic ringmaster in their cramped little office on Regent Street near the Café Royal, where black cigarettes burn to nubs between their stained fingers, smoke and mirrors and magic. In London, the spies conspired to end the war, to fleece the Germans, to fool Hitler. In the beginning, Garbo was just a situation to be assessed, a potential problem that Cyril had identified, while everyone else at MI5 was scrambling around the country, searching for the man in their midst. He'd pondered the notion that the man might not be there at all, but that perhaps he was back in Lisbon or Madrid, in which case he'd been lying to the Germans. And if he'd been lying to the Germans, their luck was even more brilliant than any of the Englishmen dared hope. For ages now, the spy had been trying to ally himself with them. It seemed that the funny little man, with his shiny, prematurely empty pate, and his mischievous eyes sparkling and darting, and his lips that fell into a de facto smile, that funny little man, Juan Pujols, with his self-imposed allegiances and his humanist compass, he had approached offices and agencies, embassies and emissaries, offering his assistance, and time after time they turned him away, until the night that the stage was set. Cyril Mills and Tommy Harris arrived on the dock on a satisfactorily foggy English evening near Plymouth, and they waited. Cyril observed his companion, the painter, a dark maverick with a sense of compassion and a Hebrew pallor that led their office mates to call him Jesus, as he lit another cigarette and anxiously surveyed the horizon. If Cyril the ringmaster could have seen himself in his long gray trench and his pale bony face and his salty pepper hair, looking as English and as somber as the fog that hung about him in the harbor, he would have known that his name, the one he would introduce himself to Juan Pujols with when he arrived, Mr. Gray, was a perfect choice. So Jesus and Mr. Gray waited, twitching and wondering what the funny little man would have to say for himself when he arrived. And when the actor stepped on stage, everything changed. The focus of the 20 committee and the Germans' understanding of the Allies' plan and history. They shepherded the shivering Spaniard into a dark car and brought him to an unassuming house in the center of London and began to ask him questions. And they began to suspect that there was indeed a reason to feel hopeful. He would need a new name. Of that, Cyril was certain. Agent Broville lacked gravitas. And though Pujols had helped them avoid that sinking feeling, there was so much more to him than that. To have single-handedly fooled the Germans for so long, selling them garbage like the Scottish loving wine or speaking of English currency only in shillings, and to have them suspect nothing. He must be, Cyril thought, the greatest actor in the world. There was a poster on a movie house just across, advertising the two-faced woman about the leading lady's double life, starring Greta Garbo. Garbo, the perfect name. Offering his suggestion to Jesus, Harris's lips cracked into an uncharacteristic smile. Knowing Cyril did not speak a word of Spanish, he marveled at what a perfect moniker he'd chosen. One meaning panache, grace, perfectionism. No, they could call him nothing else. And so it was that Cyril Mills, circus impresario and talent scout, found the greatest act of World War II. It became a most splendid fiction as the painter and the actor and the ringmaster struck the delicate balance between falsehoods that could pass for truth and truth dressed up like lies. Rather than recruiting more double agents, none of whom could match Garbo's conviction, the maestros of MI5 simply invented fictitious, wholly imagined, but realistic agents. 27 of them, in fact, each more unique, more spectacular than the next. From Fred, the Gibraltar waiter, to Rags, the Indian poet, to the pro-Aryan sect in Wales, they balance them all. The spy ring had grown to such an impressive size that Germany saw no need to infiltrate England any further. And strangely, their fiction became reality, and their reality became fiction, and they began to live in layers. Harris became Agent 3, an independently wealthy Venezuelan that fed the Abwehr lies from Scotland. The painter became practiced in the art of deception, his terse messages indelible strokes of genius. With a skilled precision and an articulate hand, he created the false portrait of a false force that would frame the team's final work of art. Garbo, always the thespian, commanded the attention of the German intelligence with his theatricality and total command of character. As a Nazi, there was none more fanatical and fervent in their allegiance to the Führer, feigning indignation when they failed to appreciate the urgency of his communiques or the importance of the situation in England. He earned a respect that he did not want but exploited. At the center of it all was Cyril, the man behind the curtain, far away in Canada, accompanied by only his secretary, Pixie Verall. Pushed into the limelight in his role as Agent 5, Moonbeam, he gave a command performance while executing his backroom duties, interrogating U-boat sailors, managing double agents, and all the while disseminating disinformation to Berlin. And then the curtain rose for the most astounding performance in history. As the days grew longer and warmer, as spring slipped away, the plans for Operation Overlord were becoming reality, but not in the reality established by the painter, the actor, and the ringmaster. Their reality, Operation Fortitude, insisted upon a Norwegian invasion and a landing at Calais. But Hitler knew. He insisted upon it. In the war room, feverishly tapping a map, this toy soldiers placed on Normandy. However, upon learning that Alaric himself, the master of the Arabelle ring in Britain, promised an incursion at Calais, all the Führer's horses and all of his men were pushed to those beaches instead, leaving Utah and Omaha and gold and Juno and sword exposed. As the Higgins boats approached these beaches, the toy soldiers waited in Calais, pointing their guns at an empty channel in Operation Fortitude, which would never come. The Americans and the British and the Australians and Canadians smoked them if they had them, loaded their guns, and kissed a crucifix around their neck and stormed the beaches. The call was finally received, and irate Juan Pujols, Garbo, Alaric reached the Germans with the news that they were coming, news which Eisenhower himself had allowed him to deliver only a moment too late. Now that the Allies had landed in France, the question became, how long could the maestros of deception keep the Germans at bay? The actor, offering a sterling performance, called Normandy a diversion and insisted that the real invasion would come later. He insisted that they wait, and they did. Long enough for the Allies to take the beach, and then Paris, and then victory. And so they'd won the war, and he'd done his part for his country, but it was time to go home. Time to go back to the circus. Had he ever really left? They were calling MI5 and MI6 by that cheeky moniker now, the circus. Since the SOE, the Sabotage and Subversion Organization, had been housed in the Mills family home at 1 Dorset Square throughout the war. And they really weren't so very different, those two circuses. Yes, just a few loose ends to tie up, then back across the pond. And then you'd run away with the circus once more. Garbo was being covertly showered with post-war accolades, his importance and his accomplishments clear. People like Churchill and Generals Eisenhower and Patton and the new President Truman, what a sorry lot he'd walked into, and the recently deceased FDR, they'd all expressed their thanks and approval. As Cyril cooperated with the FBI procuring a shoe for Garbo, a file folder full of false papers and passports and visas, he received word that J. Edgar Hoover was anxious to meet the spy. J. Edgar was the P.T. Barnum of American espionage. And maybe that made Guy Liddell, Hoover's British counterpart, something like his father, Bertram Mills. But in his heart, despite all the cloak and dagger adventures, he was Bertram's boy. Yes, it was time again for Cyril to be about his father's business, so back once more to Olympia went the prodigal son. Of course, he didn't dissolve his allegiances to the SIS. He would still provide garish circus vans for covert transport. He would continue to make reports and meet with the chaps he'd befriended. And he would keep their secrets. No, they weren't so very different, those two circuses. There were moments when he might be watching one of his latest discoveries performing some incredible feat. And he might wonder if there was really any difference at all. Spies and circus performers had to be subject to a certain kind of madness and endowed with a certain kind of talent that seemed to radiate from a near supernatural depth and looked like there was nothing artificial or forced about it at all. Cyril was gazing up at John Sedell, Little John, the Wonder Boy, who'd been performing some of these tricks since he was just 7 years old in Denmark. Now here he was in Olympia, 25 feet in the air, on a raised platform with a pedestal table and a cane centered upon it. And John was pressing down on the cane in a perfectly aligned, perfectly controlled handstand, supporting his entire weight with one hand. That kind of balance might seem impossible to most audiences, but Cyril knew it was attainable, if only through sharp focus and keen awareness of the pain and devastation that a fall might represent. Cyril had balanced like that during a planned code named Mr. Mills' Circus, which spelled out arrangements for double agents in his command to be carried out in the event that the Germans invaded England. Memos were laced with circus jargon. One report, which he recalled, stated that his operatives stood ready to care for the animals and their young in such a case. Of course, by 1944, invasion seemed less likely. And Cyril sighed in relief as he destroyed the materials associated with Mr. Mills' circus. Papers and petrol visas and handcuffs and guns. And he thought of the camps. The camps. That was another situation that had required a very delicate and intentional balance. The Bertram Mills Circus winter quarters had become an internment camp for Axis prisoners of war, where armed guards patrolled as captured Nazis slept in apartments designed for elephants or lions on beds of straw, and they went without news or newspapers, but they had hot tea, at least, because they were, after all, civilized. A careful balance between cages and decorum. Cyril sidestepped a rogue crocodile, loose from its practice pen, pursued by a tall brunette with wild hair and truly mesmerizing eyes. He took up this matter with her, Renee Bernard Coringa, asking one of the highest earners in his circus to please, please keep a tighter rein on... Which one is that? Ah, Churchill. Of course. And reminded her that they could not afford another Lancashire incident. Lancashire was the site where Goebbels, another cranky crocodile, had attempted a grand escape. During Coringa's hypnosis act, the reptile had broken her gaze and made straight for the footlights, unaware that the orchestra pit lay just beyond the glow. And in went the beast, down on top of the axe, musical accompaniment. Coringa grasped the tail of the fugitive and hauled him back on stage before looking him in the eye, scolding him for his insolence, and whacking him on the end of his many-toothed snout.
Mills had billed the Frenchwoman, Coringa, the only female fakir in the world. A false identity of which Harrison Garbo surely would have approved. Then Coringa, with her hair teased to 3 times the size of her head and the entire figure dusted with iridescent green powder, continued her act, dancing on broken glass, climbing sword ladders, and entering the pit of snakes. Luckily, the only victims of the crocodile's bid for freedom had been a cello, a trombone, badly bent, and 1 drum. Mills wondered if training a crocodile was anything like turning a spy. It couldn't be so different. It seemed the most important thing in either case was looking them in the eye and letting them know you weren't afraid. So he concluded, as he walked toward the Special Forces Club on that day in 1984, that the circus and his circus were not so different. He was early. He took a seat at the bar, waiting for the others, and he was delighted to discover a bowl of peanuts, for which he'd always had a fondness, waiting for him. He was reminded of Bora, the king of pickpockets and the pickpocket of kings, who loved a good joke and excelled in the art of prestidigitation. One night, as they dined together, Bora had distracted Cyril by lifting the waiter's watch before asking him for the time. At that same moment, Bora had replaced the peanuts which Mr. Mills had been so enjoying with a batch the pickpocket had hollowed out and filled with cayenne pepper. Bora, without a doubt, he was one of a kind. Another banner performer. He delighted detectives of Scotland Yard, stealing glasses from their faces and placing them on his own without detection, capturing pocket watches and handcuff keys and even a pair of braces. Audiences had always loved Bora. He got by on his charm and his imagination and his brazen, almost defiant confidence in his own ability. He was a wonderful actor. But Cyril had found a lot of truth in his assertion that deep down, we're all criminals. Cyril had heard Bora described as the only thief who gave back more than he stole. True enough, he thought. Maybe he could think of one more. Shame about Garbo, he thought. In 1948, word had come that he died of a snake bite of all things, or was it malaria? Something tropical. Exotic. At any rate, it happened in Mozambique. Just as he set about trying to piece together the bits he could remember of the story of the death of Juan Pujols, the other retired agents arrived, and they all shook hands and discussed snippets of nothing. Mimi was well. The children were well. The grandchildren were well, he said, as he wondered why they'd all been called here. And took his seat at the table. Just then, the door of the club swung open and revealed a funny little man with a completely bare pate and mischievous eyes sparkling and darting and lips that curled into a de facto smile. Cyril rose to his feet, astonished. The most unbelieving man behind the curtain, that old ringmaster, Spymaster, felt his shell of skepticism crack as the man came further into the dim light of the club. "I don't believe it," he heard himself exclaim. "It can't be you. You're dead." And it was true. Here, what seemed like a lifetime later, he embraced his old friend Garbo and remembered what it was like to be taken in by an act with a wonderful twist that no one could have seen coming. Yes, this was the joy of the circus. So you see, sometimes it's good to be surprised. It can help you remember who you are, who you were, who you wanted to be. Shorten the distance between the two, maybe. And Make it so you don't have to feel that you're acting all the time. But why start now, right? Trying out different roles can't hurt. Why don't you put this on? Here, first the coat. And turn around.
So smart.
Now, that.
Well, I believe
that I've just pulled something out of your hat. And I didn't even know we were doing a trick. Oh, what do we have here? We have another riddle. This is a game, all right. You always did love riddles. Oh, what does it say?
What does it say? It says,
out of the eater, something to eat. Out of the strong, something sweet. We're gonna need to make our way to the Menage tent. But stay close, okay? I don't think we're alone.